meetings, he would say. We don't need footage of those. Let's save some money. Edwards would resist. When Hunter wanted access to some event that Brumberger thought she shouldn't attend, Edwards would order, "Let her do it," or plead, "Come on, just let her do it," or lean over and whisper conspiratorially, "Just let her do it this one time." It didn't take a genius to suss the warning signs, and Brumberger was no fool. He had been worried about Hunter since she first came on the road, when he Googled her and discovered that, in her party girl past, she had been the model for the ostensibly jaded, cocaine-addled, sexually voracious character Allison Poole in Jay McInerney's novel Story of My Life. It took Josh a while to screw up his courage, but he finally did, knocking on Edwards' hotel room door one day that summer in Ohio. "I'm not accusing you of anything," Brumberger nervously said, "but I need you to know there's a perception out there that you have a different relationship with Riel than you do with everybody else, and we're in the perception game, and we know that perception becomes reality. I just need you to be cognizant of it, because your staff is starting to talk." Edwards nodded and smiled reassuringly. "I get it," he said. "Thank you. Say no more. I hear you loud and clear." Brumberger exhaled and walked out of the room thinking, "Yes! Home run!" But nothing changed. If anything, Edwards' behavior became even more brazen. At the end of August, he brought Hunter over to the family's new mansion outside Chapel Hill. She spent the whole afternoon and evening exploring the place, shooting footage of his family with her video camera. His parents were there, happily answering questions about their son. His two younger children were there, too, and Riel lingered with them, interviewing both one-on-one on camera, delighting them by showing an interest in their opinions. Elizabeth was up in Cambridge that day, dropping off their oldest daughter, Kate, at Harvard Law School. Hunter made herself at home, prowling comfortably around the big house, taking off her shoes, curling up on the sofa. She stayed for dinner with Edwards, the children's nanny, and some family intimates. Brumberger's dealings with Hunter, meanwhile, were getting testy. Increasingly, she treated him and the rest of the staff as if they worked for her, and Edwards was doing nothing to stop it. On a trip to Missouri over Labor Day weekend, it had been decided that Edwards would fly back east on the private plane alone, with the staff traveling commercial. Hunter objected, demanding a seat on the jet with Edwards. An argument ensued. Edwards sided with Hunter. Brumberger was fed up. Arriving back home in New York, he picked up the phone and called his boss. "This is hard," Brumberger began. "I don't know how to say this, but I'm really worried about where your head is. I came to you in Ohio. I thought I got through, but the problem has just escalated and gotten a lot worse, and now I'm really, really worried." "Okay," Edwards said frostily. "Anything else?" Brumberger was beside himself now. He flew down to Washington and met with Baldick, Peter Scherr, who'd been Edwards' chief of staff for the 2004 general election, and Kim Ruby, Edwards' press secretary. For Baldick, the alarm bells had started ringing even earlier when he got a look at the first webisode produced by Hunter. It was filled with so much flirty banter and over-familiarity between her and Edwards that it made Baldick cringe. When he and his wife watched it at home in bed on Baldick's laptop, she turned to him at once and said, "Oh my God, he's fucking her." Somebody senior had to confront Edwards. They all agreed. The first to try was Hickman, who'd known him the longest and was often tapped for difficult conversations with John. Hickman phoned and gingerly said that people were talking about him and Hunter. "One of the things people most admire about you is your commitment to Elizabeth. You don't want to mess that up." "I know what you're saying," Edwards replied. "I'll deal with that." Scherr was next to raise the issue, traveling up to New York from Washington and meeting Edwards in his room at the Regency. "So you think I'm fucking her?" Edwards asked. "Well, are you?" Scherr pressed. Edwards said he wasn't. "Well, if you're not, everyone thinks you are," Scherr replied. "So unless she's going to play some vital role in your future that I don't understand," he continued, "it seems to me that she shouldn't be traveling with you anymore." Edwards calmly agreed. So calmly, in fact, that Scherr took it as a clear indication that he and Hunter were having an affair. "If someone accused me of cheating on my wife, I'd say, go fuck yourself," he thought. A few days later, Brumberger flew from New York to Chicago to join Edwards, who'd come in from North Carolina for the start of a trip to China. Hey, I need to talk to you, Edwards said abruptly when they met in the terminal at O'Hare. They walked together to the airline's premium lounge, where Edwards had reserved a private meeting room for their conversation. Sit, Edwards said, and then tore into Brumberger. Stuff from the road is getting back to people, and it's obviously you who's doing it, Edwards said angrily, his southern drawl rapidly rising. You didn't recognize who you work for. You don't work for Nick and Peter. You work for me. I trusted you like a son, but you broke my trust. I can't have you around me anymore. You're not coming to China, and you're never working for me again. Brumberger's heart sank. I'm sorry you feel that way, he said. I always thought my goal in all of this was to do everything I could to help you become the next president of the United States. Why didn't you come to me? Edwards asked. I did come to you. I came to you in Ohio. I called you after Labor Day. I tried. No, Edwards said. Why didn't you come to me like a fucking man and tell me to stop fucking her? They were both yelling now at the top of their lungs, red-faced and teary-eyed. You're a 27-year-old kid and I'm a grown man, Edwards railed. Don't you think I've thought about this? But when Edwards finally regained his composure, he seemed to recognize the implications of sacking Brumberger. Let's talk about all this when I get back, he said. But Brumberger had had enough. Crushed and mortified, he was finished with Edwards. It would be a very long time before they spoke again. Brumberger's firing sent shockwaves through the Edwards sphere. Baldick, Ruby, and longtime communications advisor David Ginsburg followed him out the door. All three gave Edwards other pretexts for quitting, but there was no escaping the conclusion that the candidate was diddling Hunter and that he was hell-bent on resisting the efforts of the people closest to him to save him from himself. The departure of much of Edwards' inner circle only weeks before he planned to declare his candidacy didn't seem to trouble him. Most of his team had clashed with Elizabeth, so he could chalk it up to that. The valley of staff was getting smaller, so much the better. Hunter was still traveling with him everywhere, while Elizabeth had been a distant figure from the campaign for much of the fall. Her new book, Saving Graces, was a huge success, charting high on the bestseller lists. She was even more famous now, more iconic, more beloved than her husband by a mile. She appeared on Oprah and countless other TV shows, establishing a broad constituency of fans. Elizabeth had never crossed Hunter's path until the afternoon of December 30th, 2006, in Chapel Hill, at the last stop on the announcement tour for John's presidential bid, which Riel was on hand to shoot. Elizabeth and her family were waiting at the campaign headquarters in a small room with big windows overlooking an expansive lawn below. Hundreds of people were there for the rally, milling around outside, listening to a bluegrass band. Edwards and his aides arrived straight from the airport and breezed into the room. Hunter was toting her camera, sticking like glue to Edwards, acting the way she always did, too familiar, too intimate. Always jealous of anyone, male or female, who seemed close to John, Elizabeth watched Hunter working the room. The expression on Mrs. Edwards' face said, "Who is this woman, and what is she doing here?" Icily, Elizabeth asked Hunter to back off. "Excuse me, we're trying to have some privacy," she said. As Edwards took the stage, Hunter rushed to get into position to film his speech. Elizabeth, her brother, and her sister-in-law observed Hunter's movements. Onlookers watched them engage in an animated conversation in which Elizabeth was visibly upset. When the whole wretched business eventually became public, Elizabeth would claim that her husband revealed to her the next morning that he had slept with Hunter, but that it had happened only once, and afterward he was consumed with remorse. Her first reaction, she would say, was that John should leave the race, but he convinced her that dropping out immediately after the announcement would raise suspicions that would be hard to put to rest. Whatever was actually said between them, by the next afternoon, Elizabeth was on the phone with members of Team Edwards, issuing marching orders. Hunter's contract was to end, the webisodes to be pulled from the internet, the raw video retrieved as soon as possible. "That woman is crazy. Get rid of her," Elizabeth said. And John professed agreement. "We have to get the tapes back," he told one of his aides. "She's dangerous." And with that, Riel Hunter disappeared. But not really, and not for long. They all sat in silence around the square table in the middle of the Edwards' living room in the new estate on Old Greensboro Road. It was late in the afternoon on March 21st, 2007, and John and Elizabeth had called their closest aides together to talk about her health. It had been a roller coaster of a day, with Elizabeth at the hospital for hours of tests and difficult talks with her doctors. The news had been dark, pitch black dark, for a while, but now it was merely bad, which made it seem almost good. John explained that Elizabeth's cancer had returned and moved from breast to bone. Calmly, clinically, he explained the diagnosis and prognosis. It was treatable, but incurable. Among the handful of aides gathered in the room and listening in by phone, more than a few wished that Edwards would use the development as an excuse to leave the race. And if Elizabeth really wanted him to quit after learning about the affair with Hunter, this presented the perfect opportunity for him to do so, no questions asked. For the past 3 months, as the campaign got underway, Elizabeth and John had been fighting savagely on the road, sometimes causing events to be delayed. She was telling friends that John had changed, that he no longer cared about anybody but himself. To a longtime aide, she put the question, "Don't you think he's kind of messianic?" But Elizabeth didn't ask her husband to get out. She insisted that he stay in. "We can't let my cancer impact the future of the country," she told the group that day. "He has to run. He has to be president. I believe it's the most important thing that we can do." Their decision set off a national debate. Should a candidate continue with a grueling campaign when there was serious illness at home? Was it fair to Elizabeth? Was it fair to the children? Would it be fair to the country if he won to have a president with such a trauma consuming his attention? But John and Elizabeth insisted they were doing what they knew was best, for themselves, their family, and the voters. And despite whatever doubts existed in some quarters, it generally was accepted that Elizabeth had a right to determine how she spent her time, even if she preferred to continue the exhausting fight to get her husband elected president rather than rest quietly at home. Edwards' position in the race was strong at the start. He'd come flying out of the gate, offering up a flurry of bold and concrete policy plans, notably on health care and global warming. He was in the driver's seat in Iowa. His relationship with labor was tight. His early fundraising was surprisingly robust, $14 million in the first quarter of the year. Not nearly as much as Clinton or Obama, but double his take in the same period 4 years earlier. Obama's entry, John and Elizabeth believed, didn't alter their original assessment of the contest. Barack was a phenomenon, no doubt about that, but one that would pass. In the wake of the Hunter flare-up and the recurrence of Elizabeth's cancer, the dynamic between husband and wife shifted in the context of the campaign. He was more deferential to her, she was even more assertive. Former Congressman David Bonier, the campaign's new manager, had no experience running a presidential operation and struck much of the staff as an extremely nice but very clueless guy. Elizabeth seemed to love having Bonier nominally in charge because it meant that, in effect, she was in charge. On everything from hiring to advertising, her influence was singular. She pushed John hard on policy, always to the left. On health care in particular, she lobbied vociferously in meeting after meeting for him to embrace a single-payer plan as the route to universal coverage. In television interviews, on blogs, and on the trail, Elizabeth was outspoken in support of her causes, at times advocating policies in favor of gay marriage, for instance, more progressive than her husband's. In 2004, Edwards' campaign had been sunny, centrist, and thematic. Elizabeth prodded him toward being hotter, more populist, and more sharply ideological and anti-establishment. And in that cause, she enlisted a new ally, bringing into the campaign that spring the consultant Joe Trippi, for whom tilting at the establishment was akin to breathing. Trippi was a piece of work. At 50, he had toiled for 7 previous presidential hopefuls, from Ted Kennedy to Gary Hart to Dick Gephardt to Howard Dean. Brilliant, eccentric, and mildly unbalanced, he'd long been a pioneer in applying new technology to politics. Though John Edwards was interested in Trippi mainly because he thought the shaman had some magic formula for turning the web into a fundraising spigot, Elizabeth was enamored of his heady talk of transforming the campaign into a movement. Trippi thought John was high in his own vapors and considering himself equal to Clinton and superior to Obama, but he also believed that if Edwards could beat them both in Iowa, it might be enough of a game changer to propel him to the nomination. The day after Trippi joined the campaign in mid-April, he got a call from a reporter inquiring about whether Edwards had received a $400 haircut. Another question he heard early on from a member of the Edwards sphere struck him as even more unsettling. What are you going to do about the girlfriend? Dude, what are you talking about? Trippy wondered. Trippy soon learned that the haircut was, in fact, just one of three interrelated imbroglios that would plague Edwards for months. Inside the campaign, they called them the three H's: the haircuts, the hedge fund, and the house. Edwards' advisors had warned John about the perils of the new house from the first time they saw the blueprints. It was a two-building complex totaling 28,200 square feet with an indoor basketball court, swimming pool, and squash court, two theatrical stages, and a room designated John's Lounge. Staring at the designs, Baldick said, "Is there any foliage to cover the house?" At which Hickman cracked, "Are you kidding? They clear-cut a whole forest to build it." But the house was a cancer thing, a gift to Elizabeth at the time when the disease first appeared. When John's advisors pointed out that such a gaudy manse might be a political liability for an aspiring neo-populist, he said, "It's Elizabeth's project, and I can't deny her this." When the place was ridiculed in the media, by Jay Leno, among many others, Elizabeth responded that her new home was not grand, but functional. The hedge fund was John's deal to be a senior advisor to Fortress Investment Group in New York, from which he reaped a minor fortune. Edwards signed on in October 2005 without even telling his team he was doing it. He justified it by saying he needed the money. The Edwardses burned through cash at an astounding rate, on everything from real estate to internet shopping, to which Elizabeth was apparently addicted, filling their house with unopened boxes containing items she'd bought online. By December 2006, John had left Fortress, but the damage was done, especially since he kept some of his money in the firm, which was implicated in a welter of foreclosures in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and a ton of subprime lending, two damning facts that became subjects of considerable media interest in 2007. Edwards already had an image problem when it came to his hair, due to a bootleg YouTube video set to a soundtrack of "I Feel Pretty" that caught him fussing with his coif before a TV interview. But now there was a story that he'd received two $400 cuts from a posh Beverly Hills stylist who later revealed that he'd once charged Edwards $1,250 for a session back in 2004. The instinct of Team Edwards was to make a joke of John's follicular follies, but Elizabeth had other ideas. The story drove her to distraction, to the point where, over the summer, she shot a homemade response video in the backyard of their beach house, with her and John boasting about how little they paid for her engagement ring. She sent the staff the video and told them to post it on the campaign's website. Cooler heads eventually prevailed. The Edwards campaign was certain that the Clintonites were driving the three H's, planting the stories in the press at the national level and also in the four early states. And it was true. Frustrated by the media's indifference to its attempts to stoke negative coverage of Obama, the Clinton operation was pushing hard on the hedge fund and the haircuts. The Edwardses saw the effort as a sign of respect, an indication that Hillary was feeling threatened by John. Their advisors tried to spin journalists that the three H's were nothing more than a preoccupation of the media, that voters didn't give a damn. But in fact, the campaign's research suggested otherwise, especially regarding the House. Fair or not, the impact on Edwards' image was undeniable. The three H's reinforced doubts about his substantiveness and, more damaging, his authenticity. Problematic as all that was, however, it paled beside another threat that returned as the summer turned to fall. Suddenly, it appeared that a fourth H might be added to the list, an H that could have stood for honey or for hussy, but either way, stood for Hunter. Roger Altman picked up the phone in his 38th floor office on the east side of New York and found John Edwards on the line. Altman, the former deputy treasury secretary who was then secretly planning Hillary Clinton's White House transition, was chairman of the investment group Evercore Partners. Since 1999, Evercore had owned a stake in American Media, the publisher of the National Enquirer, and it was that connection that prompted an agitated Edwards to call Altman one day in the first week of October. "There's a story about to come out in the Enquirer," Edwards said, "which is going to allege that I had an affair with a woman who used to travel with my campaign. The story is untrue and outrageous, he insisted. It's going to be extremely hurtful to my family. Could you please do something to stop it? Altman barely knew Edwards, but Catelli was upset. I haven't heard a word about this, Altman said. I'll look into it, but there's really nothing I can do. He had some sympathy for Edwards. The Inquirer had been a thorn in Altman's side for years, especially when it published embarrassing pieces on his powerful friends. So he called David Pecker, the Inquirer's publisher, and asked him about the story. We have evidence, Pecker told him. This thing could have a big impact on this guy, so let's be triply sure, Altman said. Pecker replied that he already was. A little later, Altman's phone buzzed again. This time it was Elizabeth, in tears. You must do something about this, she begged. It's cruel, it's unfair, and it's untrue. This is way too much for me. I can't take it. It's killing our family. It's killing me. Altman was torn up by Elizabeth's distress. He knew, of course, that she was ill. He considered her the victim in this sordid episode. But Altman's hands were tied. I'm really sorry, Mrs. Edwards, he said. I'm really, really sorry. The Inquirer story didn't come completely out of left field for the Edwards sphere. Back in April and May, there had been whispers that Hunter had reappeared, with rumored sightings of her at hotels where Edwards was staying. An advance staffer sent up to his boss's room to retrieve something had come upon a woman matching Hunter's description. Then, over the summer, a reporter from the Huffington Post began digging into the sudden disappearance of the webisodes from the One America site. The HuffPost story, published in September, was mild, full of insinuations, but no direct allegations. There was little that was elliptical about the Inquirer story that hit the streets on October 10th, however. Presidential candidate John Edwards is caught in a shocking mistress scandal that could wreck his campaign, was the lead, and the article went on to cite a bombshell email message in which the other woman confesses to a friend she's in love with John, but it's difficult because he is married and has kids. The next morning, John and Elizabeth were scheduled to fly out of Raleigh to separate destinations, he to South Carolina, she to Iowa. But when the traveling staff arrived at their home, they found Elizabeth out of sorts, disconsolate, still in her bathrobe. She had drafted a blog post that she wanted to have published, defending her husband from the accusations against him. This kind of tawdriness was something the Clintons would be involved in, she wrote, but not the Edwardses. The staff persuaded Elizabeth that posting such an item would do more harm than good, but she was livid about what she saw as the campaign's feeble response to the story. After pulling herself together, she and John set off for the private aviation terminal at the airport. But partway there, their car pulled over, and John got out and jumped into the staff car, saying in an exasperated tone, I can't ride with her. At the terminal, the couple fought in the passenger waiting area. They fought outside in the private parking lot. Elizabeth was sobbing, out of control, incoherent. As their aides tried to look away, she tore off her blouse, exposing herself. Look at me, she wailed at John, and then staggered, nearly falling to the ground. John tried to bring down the temperature, remaining calm and impassive, but his apparent standoffishness only seemed to infuriate and disorient Elizabeth more. Finally, after talking to her doctor on the phone, Edward sent his wife home and flew off to South Carolina. There, outside a barbecue joint in Somerton, Edwards was asked by a reporter about the Inquirer's story. He offered a paean to Elizabeth. I've been in love with the same woman for 30-plus years, and as anybody who's been around us knows, she's an extraordinary human being, warm, loving, beautiful, sexy, and as good a person as I have ever known, coupled with the blanket claim that the story's just false, but no denial of the specific allegations it contained. Out of view, the Edwards campaign was in damage control mode, going into overdrive to dissuade the mainstream media from picking up the story, denouncing it as tabloid trash. Their efforts at containing the fallout were remarkably successful. The Inquirer's expose gained zero traction in the traditional press and almost none in the blogosphere. Edwards' relief was palpable, as was his gratitude to the small coterie of aides who had corralled the story. It's John, he began in a voicemail to one of them. I just wanted to call and thank you for everything you've done in the past few days. It hasn't been easy, I know that, and I want you to know how grateful I am for everything you've done. We'll get through this together. Don't worry, man. The next voicemail in the staffer's queue was from Elizabeth, who vented her fury that the story had appeared in any form, suspicious that the very aides who had kept the matter from mushrooming had somehow enabled the affair. "You're to have nothing more to do with this," Elizabeth hissed. "Nothing more. You stay away from our family. You are poison. You're dead to us." For John Edwards, the narrow escape should have been hair-raising, his wife's humiliation chastening. But instead of being tossed into turmoil or depression, Edwards seemed as resolved and optimistic as ever about his prospects. To his way of thinking, he was as plausible a nominee in October 2007 as he had been 10 months earlier, and the outside world agreed. He had much less money than Clinton or Obama, that was true, but he had enough to hold his own in Iowa, and that was all he needed. He was consistently rated in the top tier alongside Clinton and Obama, the rest of the field dismissed as a jumble of interchangeable long shots. The press corps credited his Iowa-only strategy and saw him as having a decent chance there. Obama's poor standing in the national polls seemed to confirm Edwards' long-held view that the upstart was a passing fad. How to get past Hillary was the question. At the urging of Trippi, Edwards had recently adopted a harsher tone with the frontrunner, attacking her for being too close to corporate power and tainted by the special interest corruption in Washington. At a debate in Chicago sponsored by the AFL-CIO, Edwards fired a populist broadside at a recent appearance of Clinton on the cover of a national publication, with her smiling face above the headline, "Business Loves Hillary." "I want everyone here to hear my voice on this," Edwards declared. "The one thing you can count on is you will never see a picture of me on the front of Fortune magazine saying I am the candidate that big corporate America is betting on. That will never happen. That's one thing you can take to the bank." To Edwards' eye, his punches seemed to be landing on the mark. When he ran into Clinton backstage at the event, her hostility was evident, which delighted him. "She won't look at me," Edwards told his aides triumphantly. "I'm getting under her skin." But Edwards knew that even if he beat Clinton in Iowa, she would be a resilient foe. He began to ponder the possibility of a novel and radical anti-Hillary strategy, teaming up with Obama to run on a joint ticket against Clinton after the caucuses. He raised the idea with Hickman early that fall. "Who's going to be number one and number two?" the pollster asked. Edwards replied, "He would be my running mate." The idea was far out, certainly, but no less odd than pretty much everything about Edwards' situation as he headed into the Iowa home stretch. Riel Hunter was hanging over his head. His wife was apparently on the verge of a breakdown. But Edwards was undaunted. All he needed was a little help. If he could just get Obama to lend him a hand, everything in the end might, just might, turn out golden.
Chapter 8. The Turning Point. They took the stage in the auditorium at Drexel University just before 9 p.m. on Wednesday, October 30th. Biden, Clinton, Dodd, Edwards, Obama, Richardson, and Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. The candidates in various combinations had appeared at more than a dozen previous debates or forums. Their interchanges had been informative on occasion, entertaining less often, and almost entirely free of impact on the basic contours of the race. Clinton was the comfortable frontrunner, Edwards and Obama her obtrusive challengers, and the rest irrelevant also-rans. But the debate at Drexel would be different. Looking back on it later, the candidates and their advisors would all agree what happened that night in Philadelphia changed everything. Dominating debate after debate had bred a certain complacency in Clinton and a distinct disdain for Obama. After many of them, Hillary would privately lambast Obama for comparing his meager record to hers and Dodd's and Biden's. Every now and then on stage, the three of them would share furtive eye rolls over Obama's self-regard. "What an asshole," Clinton, employing her favorite profanity, grumbled to her aides. "Am I the only one who sees the arrogance? Does that not bother people?" Hillary knew that Obama intended to play offense at Drexel. The Sunday before the debate, the New York Times had run a front-page story based on the table-setting interview that Obama and his team had planned weeks earlier. In it, Obama claimed Clinton was being less than truthful about her positions, that she was acting like a Republican on foreign policy, that she was too divisive to win a general election or unify the country. "We have to make these distinctions clearer," he said, "and I will not shy away from doing that." The Obama plan worked.
The initial question of the debate was directed to him by moderator Brian Williams. The topic was the Times story, but Obama bobbled the ball, backing away from his charges. "I think some of this stuff gets overhyped," he said. In the opening segment of the debate, Edwards' attacks on Clinton were repeated and razor sharp, while Obama reverted fully into his passive, prolix, professorial mode. Edwards wondered what the hell was wrong with him. Puncturing Clinton was their mutual objective, with time running out, but only Edwards was wielding the blade. During the first intermission, he pulled Obama aside and stared him in the eyes. "Barack, you need to focus," Edwards implored. "Focus, focus, focus." The next segment opened with Hillary answering a question about her electability and appropriating a phrase of Obama's about the need to turn the page. She applied it to Bush and Cheney. Obama thought, "She stole my line," and was mocking him in the process. That did it. He finally pounced. "I'm glad that Hillary took the phrase turn the page," he said sarcastically. "It's a good one." After smacking her for refusing to release records of her time as First Lady held by the National Archives, he went on, "Part of the reason that Republicans, I think, are obsessed with you, Hillary, is that's a fight they're very comfortable having. It is the fight that we've been through since the 90s, and part of the job of the next president is to break the gridlock and get Democrats and independents and Republicans to start working together to solve these big problems, like health care or climate change or energy. And what we don't need is another 8 years of bickering." What ensued then was one of the more extraordinary group assaults in the history of presidential debates. It was 7-on-1. 5 candidates, Kucinich refrained, and 2 moderators pounding on Clinton mercilessly. With just 8 minutes left on the clock, Clinton had withstood the fusillade. At least she was still standing. Then the other moderator, Tim Russert, asked her if she supported the idea of giving driver's licenses to illegal immigrants, as New York's Democratic Governor Eliot Spitzer had proposed. Clinton ducked Russert's query, saying she sympathized with Spitzer, then pivoted to stress the need for comprehensive immigration reform. But when Dodd declared his opposition to the plan, Clinton jumped back in. "I did not say that it should be done, but I certainly recognize why Governor Spitzer is trying to do it." "Wait a minute," interjected Dodd. The senator from Connecticut considered Hillary a friend. All year long, he had held back from going after her, against the advice of many of his advisors, who were virulently anti-Clinton. But this rigmarole that she was spouting struck him as absurd. "You said yes. You thought it made sense to do it." "No, I didn't, Chris," Clinton replied, and started squabbling with Dodd. Voices escalated, eyebrows arched. The back and forth got heated. Finally, Russert stepped in and asked Clinton to clarify her position. Did she support Spitzer's plan or not? "You know, Tim, this is where everybody plays gotcha," Clinton said, gesticulating with both hands. "What is the governor supposed to do? He's dealing with a serious problem. We have failed, and George Bush has failed. Do I think this is the right thing for any governor to do? No, but do I understand the sense of real desperation trying to get a handle on this? He's making an honest effort to do it." Watching the exchange on TV in the staff room, Clinton's aides felt as if they were witnessing a car crash in slow motion. Grunwald pleaded with Hillary's pixelated image on the screen as if she were trying to advise her candidate telepathically. "Okay, that's enough," she cried. "No, no, no, stop." But it was too late. Williams tried to segue to a new topic, but Edwards wouldn't let go. "Unless I missed something, Senator Clinton said 2 different things in the course of about 2 minutes," he noted, "and I think this is a real issue for the country." Obama nodded vigorously, and Williams asked him why. "I was confused on Senator Clinton's answer," Obama said with a smirk. "I can't tell whether she was for it or against it." Clinton exited the stage both bloodied and bowed. Of the 62 questions at Drexel that weren't part of a lightning round in which all the candidates were asked the same thing, more than half were either directed to her or elicited answers that ended up being attacks on her. Only 5 times did any candidate go after someone besides her. Among the questions put to Obama, did he believe in life on other planets? What would he do to fix air travel? And what would he dress as for Halloween? On the flight home to Washington, Clinton asked her aides, "How bad was that?" Grunwald tried to be gentle but candid about the driver's license cock-up. "It wasn't great. We're going to catch some crap. We're going to need to clean it up." The next day, however, Clinton's people didn't clean it up at all. They made an even bigger mess. A statement was issued that simply reformulated her vague position from the night before. Then her press shop clarified the clarification, saying Clinton backed
the basic concept of giving driver's license to illegals, absent immigration reform. At the same time, the campaign posted on the web a 30-second video titled "The Politics of Pile-On," with intercut images of the other candidates assailing Hillary at the debate, set to music from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. The day after that, in a speech at her alma mater, Wellesley College, Clinton noted that the school had prepared me to compete in the all-boys club of presidential politics. The combination of Clinton's debate performance and the suggestion that sexism was at work unleashed a torrent of scorn from the media, and her opponents were no less scathing. The Edwards campaign produced a web video of its own, highlighting Clinton's obfuscations at the debate, called "The Politics of Parsing." The Obama campaign made a video, too, featuring unflattering shots of Clinton against a soundtrack of "Did You Ever Have to Make Up Your Mind?" Obama personally vetoed the video as too mean, but he did go on the Today Show and characterize Clinton as a whiner. One of the things that she has suggested why she should be elected is because she's been playing in this rough-and-tumble stage, so it doesn't make sense for her, after having run that way for 8 months, the first time that people start challenging her point of view, that suddenly she backs off and says, "Don't pick on me." The scale and intensity of the backlash stunned Hillary. "We need to stop talking about gender," she instructed her staff. All year long, she had shied away from putting her femaleness front and center, out of fear that it would undercut the tough-as-nails image she required to clear the commander-in-chief threshold. She had approved the piling-on video, but thought it had nothing to do with sexism, and was furious at her campaign for letting it be cast that way. But her deeper anger was directed at the media. Obama had been bad in so many debates and been given a free pass, she thought, and yet here she was, batting 1,000 until then, getting pilloried for whiffing once by a press corps lying in wait for the first excuse to nail her. She found the unfairness of it galling. The dynamics that drove the coverage were both more complex and simpler than that, of course. The press always wants a race. The press always loves conflict. Driver's licenses for illegals was a hot topic. Clinton stumbling was a man-bites-dog story, and the way she stumbled reinforced an existing stereotype of her, to which the media was certainly receptive. Nor was Clinton's campaign blameless in fomenting some of the ill will toward her. Its approach to the Fourth Estate, reflecting the candidate's disposition, had fluctuated throughout the contest between heavy-handed and outright hostile. But whatever the confluence of causes and effects, the damage to the frontrunner from the Drexel debate and its aftermath was more severe than anyone in Hillary land knew. The inevitable candidate was suddenly revealed as vulnerable. The flawless campaign looked fallible. The Clinton juggernaut had a hole in its hull, and the water was rushing in. Hillary looked down at the text of her speech and felt ill. She'd picked up a rotten cold on the road and was struggling to shake it, but that wasn't the only reason for the dull throbbing in her skull. It was Friday, November 9th, 10 days after what had turned out to be the most important debate of 2007, and one day before what was expected to be her most important address of the year. In a little more than 24 hours, she would be standing on a stage in Des Moines at the Jefferson Jackson dinner, holding forth without notes or the aid of a teleprompter, in the round before 9,000 Democrats. And yet, here she was, sitting with her aides at Whitehaven, laying eyes on her speech text for the very first time, and saying, "No, let's change this." The internal debates over what Clinton should say at the JJ had dragged on for weeks and arrived at no place good. In the past months, Obama had developed a fiery call and response that had become a trademark flourish. Fired up, ready to go. For the JJ, Clinton would have an incantation of her own. Turn up the heat on the Republicans. Nobody in Hillary land liked it except Penn, who claimed it tested well in his polling and would reinforce Clinton's image as a fighter against the GOP, in contrast to the weak and platitudinous Obama. The Clinton campaign's organizational efforts were equally haphazard. The JJ was a fundraiser for the Iowa Democratic Party. The more tickets you bought, the more supporters you could bring. Teresa Vilmaine kept badgering the people at the Ballston headquarters. "Gang, either we come up with more money now or we lose out," she said. But the Iowa team had trouble getting the budget for the JJ approved. Its request for cash to hire a band to play outside the hall to rouse the troops was rejected. When the funds for crowd building finally arrived, it was too late. The Obama campaign had already snatched up the prime seats in the place. On the night of the event, Clinton and her team arrived late to Veterans Memorial Auditorium, and Hillary retreated to a trailer to squeeze in a rushed final read-through or two. She would be the penultimate speaker, followed by Obama. The dinner had been plodding along for more than 3 hours already by the time she took the stage. Because it was so late and because her supporters tended to be older, her crowd, which was smaller than Obama's to begin with, had thinned out appreciably. Astonishingly, Clinton's rendition of her text was letter perfect. Dressed in a black pantsuit with a yellow top, she gamely built toward her signature theme. "I'll tell you what I want to do," Hillary said. "I'm not interested in attacking my opponents. I'm interested in attacking the problems of America, and I believe that we should be turning up the heat on the Republicans. They deserve all the heat we can give them." Out in the darkness of the hall, Obama's brain trust was incredulous at Clinton's message. She was talking about fighting rather than uniting, playing right into their hands. Obama's speech, indeed the entire Obama operation at the JJ, could not have been more different than the Clinton effort. Hildebrand, Tooze, and the Iowa field team treated the event as if it were a dry run for caucus night, scheduling a concert by John Legend for the foot soldiers beforehand. The Obama ranks were young, energetic, and eardrum-splitting. They went wild when their hero took the stage, as the PA system blasted an introduction by the Chicago Bulls announcer Ray Clay. "And now, from our neighboring state of Illinois, a 6'2" force for change, Senator Barack Obama." Unlike Hillary, Obama had prepared meticulously for his speech. He had road tested it a week before in Spartanburg, South Carolina. He'd spent hours in his hotel room over several days memorizing and rehearsing it. As for his message, there was never even the slightest doubt or dithering. His indictment of Hillary and her husband was subtle but unmistakable. His takedown of them a deft blend of coded language and clear implication. "We have a chance to bring the country together in a new majority," Obama declaimed. "That is why the same old Washington textbook campaigns just won't do in this election. That's why not answering questions because we are afraid our answers won't be popular just won't do. That's why telling the American people what we think they want to hear instead of telling the American people what they need to hear just won't do. Triangulating and poll-driven positions because we're worried about what Mitt or Rudy might say about us just won't do. And also, I am not in this race to fulfill some long-held ambitions or because I believe it's somehow owed to me." The decimation was interwoven with flashes of inspiration. A nation healed, a world repaired, an America that believes again. The crowd adored it all. When Obama walked off stage to Stevie Wonder's "Signed, Sealed, Delivered," the ovation was thunderous. His supporters raised the rafters with their cries of "Fired up, ready to go." Backstage, Obama spotted Axelrod, smiled, and said, "That was solid, right?" That Obama won the night dramatically was apparent even to Clinton's staunch allies. Ohio Governor Ted Strickland, who'd accompanied Hillary to the dinner, thought the shift of momentum to Obama was palpable, almost visible. Penn and Grunwald attempted to spin reporters on the notion that the youth of Obama's supporters was a negative. "Our people look like caucus-goers and his people look like they are 18, Grunwald remarked, adding dismissively, "Penn said they look like Facebook." Clinton's chief strategist chimed in, "Only a few of their people look like they could vote in any state." Hillary's loyalists took pains to praise her at a party afterward, not insincerely. But McAuliffe expressed dismay at Obama's greater show of force in the auditorium, and Villemain acknowledged that the opposition had more people in the hall. "Why?" asked Hillary. "They got their money in sooner and they had more of it," Villemain explained. "Oh," Clinton said, and walked away. But Hillary wasn't satisfied with Villemain's answer. She had a lot of questions and a lot of worries, a cascade of concerns that had been growing for a while, but that the JJ unleashed full force. She was worried that Obama seemed to be building some kind of movement in the cornfields. Movement was the word she kept hearing from Maggie Williams, who told her it was easy to run against a man, but devilishly hard to run against a cause. "I think there's something going on under the surface here," Clinton said to Penn. She was worried that Obama's team seemed to be reaching out to a new universe of potential caucus-goers. Vilsack relayed to her that her rival's canvassers were knocking on doors of Republicans and independents, an unheard-of practice in Iowa's Democratic caucuses. Clinton wondered if her side should do the same or if she should be making a play for students, especially young women. But Hillary feared that her war vote would get her hooted off any campus where she spoke. And Vilsack and Vilmaine assured her that come caucus night, if history was any guide, the non-Democrats would remain at home and the college kids, lazy or unserious, would stay in their rooms and on their Wii's. Hillary was worried, too, that the caucus system was unfair. The process required that voters show up in person and hang around for several hours on a frigid January evening. Absentee ballots weren't allowed. For people who worked the night shift, single mothers, the elderly, and active duty soldiers, all key elements of her constituency, the rules made it difficult or even impossible to participate. She was worried about some indications that Iowa simply didn't cotton to female candidates. Recently, she'd been informed by the Des Moines Register's David Yepsen, the dean of the Iowa Press Corps, that no woman had ever been elected to Congress or the governorship there. The factoid stunned Hillary, and she started repeating it constantly. Yet in spite of all her worries, Clinton decided to double down on Iowa. Millions of additional dollars started pouring into the state. Her local advertising budget soared. Her staff there was increased twofold. Her calendar was packed with Iowa travel. Hillary hated spending the money, but was convinced she had no choice, and the JJ had only reinforced that conviction. Within days, Penn's polling found that Obama was starting to open up a lead. The political gamble here was evident, but the upside was huge. If Clinton carried the caucuses, the nomination would be in the bag. If she didn't, her strength in New Hampshire and the big states on Super Tuesday might dissipate. There was another gamble, however, involved in doubling down on Iowa, a financial wager that Silas Doyle and Harold Ickes laid out for her one day in her Senate office. Hillary Land was burning cash at a prodigious rate, her advisors said. If she won Iowa, her fiscal health would be Jake. Money would come gushing into her campaign's coffers. But if Clinton fell short in the Hawkeye state, a yawning deficit loomed. Hillary was taken aback by the forecast. Where in God's name did all the money go, she thought. She looked at Silas Doyle and Ickes, set her jaw, and said, well, then, I guess we'd better win Iowa. Bill Clinton's involvement in his wife's campaign was still minimal at that point. He took part in few conference calls, had no briefing books, and was only rarely sent on the road to campaign for or with her. The fear of him overshadowing Hillary persisted. Let's make sure that he's not going to get a bigger crowd than she's going to get, Silas Doyle told the Iowa staff whenever Bill visited for separate events. But now his status was about to change. Much of Clinton's political acumen lay in his ability to synthesize three streams of data: the polling, what was happening on the ground, and what was happening with the candidate. With Hillary's campaign, his intake had been limited mainly to the numbers being fed to him by Penn, and for much of the year, those numbers had been good, deceptively good. But now, Bill was hearing ominous chatter from the members of his old political circle, most of whom had either absented themselves from Hillary Land or been locked out. His friend Carville opined that Hillary's team was stocked with joyless misanthropes who loved neither politics nor people. Well, you have to call Hillary and tell her, Clinton said beseechingly. Bill was keenly aware of Hillary's political and human liabilities, but he found it difficult to discuss them with her without raising her hackles. One day that fall, they were on a plane together, and he tried to give his wife a pep talk, while at the same time gently broaching the topic of her perceived haughtiness. I know you're working hard, he said, but you need to let them know how hard you're working for them, and you have to really dig in there. There's a belief that you're above them, and you need to really let them know who you are. Bill, I'm working 18 hours a day, Hillary snapped, ending the discussion. The former president thought he could rely on Penn as his instrument inside of Hillary's campaign, but Penn was stymied in his efforts to go negative against Obama. His colleagues at headquarters and in Iowa were firmly opposed to running attack ads. The press showed little interest in the dirt the Clinton press shop was peddling under the table, and Hillary refused to rule in favor of strafing Obama. The whole thing baffled Bill. Over the past months, his assessment of Obama had hardened. Yes, he was exciting. Yes, he was talented. Yes, he was the future. But he was also, Bill thought, an off-the-rack Chicago politician who had figured out how to have it both ways, appearing to be above bare-knuckle tactics while his team practiced them with a vengeance. In early November, for example, The Atlantic had published a story in which an unnamed Obama official plopped down next to the author and inquired as to
when reporters would begin to look into Bill Clinton's post-presidential sex life. The incident enraged Bill for reasons that went beyond the obvious. Obama was constantly bragging on the cleanness of his campaign, yet no one in the media saw fit to call him out when his hired guns egged on the press to start rummaging around in Bill's boudoir. What more evidence did anyone need that the media was in the tank for Obama? It was as if the referees were on the field wearing the opposing team's jerseys, Clinton said. Clinton grasped the rhythm of a presidential campaign as well as anyone alive. He knew there always came a moment late in the game when a candidate either found his voice or didn't, when the souffle either rose or fell. For him, the moment had come in the autumn of 1991 with a series of third-way policy speeches that propelled him into the lead. Clinton could see that the JJ had done the same for Obama and that his wife was headed in the opposite direction. Ever since Philly, the press had been all over Hillary and not just about the debate. There were stories about her staff planting questions at town hall meetings in Iowa, about her failing to leave a tip at a made-right diner. She was being buffeted by external flaps, distracted by overblown hassles, coping with internal disagreements, and all the while not only failing to find her homestretch groove, but looking ever more lost out there. Hillary sensed it too. Her Iowa stump speech was a themeless pudding, laundry listy and flat, but she was too busy lurching from crisis to crisis to find time to fix it. The story about her not leaving a tip was bullshit, plain and simple. And the one about the planted questions, well, that was true. And man, did she give her staff an earful about it. She asked them, what are we doing? We're supposed to have this organization that's the best in the world. Why do we keep making these mistakes? The press is going to turn molehills into mountains, but can we please stop giving them so many molehills to work with? One night, around Thanksgiving, the Clintons held a private meeting with Penn to discuss what they should do to staunch the bleeding and turn Iowa around. Once again, Bill and Penn pressed the argument for going negative against Obama on TV. Hillary had been hitting Obama harder of late. Voters will judge whether living in a foreign country at the age of 10 prepares one to face the big, complex international challenges the next president will face, she'd said in Iowa. I think we need a president with more experience than that. But her team was ineffective in backing her up when she took on Obama. She told Penn that she felt like a general running up a hill with a sword in her hand but no troops behind her. For months, she tried to stay on the high road, but now she'd had enough. She was ready, she announced to Penn and her husband, to commence the carpet bombing. Bill had definite ideas about how to nuke Obama. He was still obsessed, and so was Penn, with Obama's Iraq record. He was also fixated on Obama's habit of voting present in the Illinois State Senate, his less than pristine history of taking campaign cash from lobbyists, and his ties to the shady Chicago developer Tony Rezko. At Penn's instruction, Grunwald produced an array of ads revolving around those issues. She made harsh ads, mild ads, mean ads, funny ads, but when they were tested with Iowa voters, every one of them fell flat. Grunwald showed the spots to the Clintons at a meeting at Whitehaven. She explained her difficulty in finding anything that stuck. Bill told her to keep trying, offering ideas in granular detail about the scripts and visuals, but nothing worked. It began to dawn on Grunwald that the problem was that Iowans simply didn't want to hear trash talk about Obama from Hillary. They liked him, and they didn't like her, and there would be no changing that. Her negatives were just too deeply cooked into the casserole. The Clintons flew out to Iowa just after Thanksgiving in a state of irritation and anxiety. On the first night of December, they had drinks at Azalea, a swish restaurant in Des Moines, with the editorial board of the Register and some of its political reporters. Hillary was working hard for the paper's endorsement. Bill was gathering intelligence, chatting up the beat reporter who was covering Hillary's campaign. The reporter told him that the Obamans were regularly feeding her negative information about Hillary, but that no one from the Clinton team was doing the same regarding Obama. When the drinks were over, Bill related the story to Hillary. The next morning, she woke up simmering and then received yet more bad news. One of her most trusted aides confided that he'd spoken the night before with Karen Hicks, a veteran field organizer who had been dispatched to Des Moines to fortify the Iowa operation. Karen's unhappy, the aide told Hillary. The Iowa team isn't getting what it needs from headquarters. Phone calls aren't being returned. Decisions aren't getting made. Hillary's aide didn't cast blame explicitly on Silas Doyle or Henry, but Hillary had no difficulty in drawing the inference.
Clinton picked up the phone and got on the morning briefing call with her senior advisors and promptly blew a gasket. "Our communication shop isn't getting the job done," she growled, mentioning what she and Bill had learned during drinks the previous night. "No one is engaging with reporters," she said. "Nothing we throw at Obama is sticking. Everything he throws at us is. All the decision makers are back in Washington doing God knows what." Clinton seethed uninterrupted for 5 minutes. When she finished, there was silence. Finally, Silas Doyle offered meekly, "I'll have a plan for you this afternoon." "I've been asking you this for weeks, Patty," Hillary angrily replied. After the call, Clinton phoned Silas Doyle directly and ordered her and all the rest of the Boston High Command to head to Iowa. "You need to get out here," Hillary said. "This is too important. Pretend that nothing else exists in the country." Clinton could hardly believe where she'd found herself 5 weeks out from caucus day. Frustrated, panicky, still steaming over what she'd learned that morning, she went before reporters at an afternoon news conference in Cedar Rapids. After criticizing Obama for insisting that his health care plan was universal when it wasn't, Clinton was asked if her opponent's lack of candor on the topic meant he had a character problem. "It's beginning to look a lot like that," Hillary said. "I have said for months that I would much rather be attacking Republicans and attacking the problems of our country, because ultimately that's what I want to do as president. But I have been for months on the receiving end of rather consistent attacks. Well, now the fun part starts." Chapter 9. The Fun Part. For Obama, the fun part had already been underway for weeks. The JJ had been a slingshot for him. He was flying now. His media team put the speech front and center in TV advertising and direct mail. And its message became the core of what Obama was saying 4 or 5 or 6 times each day on the stump. At the end of November, the latest Register poll confirmed the Obama uptick. He was 3 points ahead of Clinton and 4 ahead of Edwards, a swing of 10 and 5 points, respectively, since October. In early December, his friend Oprah Winfrey traveled to Des Moines and anointed him in front of 18,000 fans. "There are those who say it's not his time, that he should wait his turn," Oprah proclaimed. "I'm sick of politics as usual. We need Barack Obama." Since the start of Obama's bid for the nomination, Plouffe had been chanting a mantra in his ear: "You need to own Iowa." Owning Iowa meant establishing a deep and intimate connection to the state. It meant visiting any county and remembering what had happened the last time he was there, whom he'd met, why they mattered. It meant doing more than appreciating the grassroots machine that Steve Hildebrand and Paul Tews were building. It meant being invested in it, living it, and breathing it, becoming one with it. It took Obama a long time to get there, but now something had clicked. All of a sudden, he was asking, "How many people am I getting? How many supporter cards? How many precinct captains?" Instead of begging off making calls, he was reaching for the phone. At rallies, he started bringing organizers up on stage and giving props to them by name, a nice idea that impressed Plouffe all the more because it was Obama's. After town hall meetings, he would take a group picture with his volunteers, and then another with the high school students in attendance, because those who'd be 18 by the general election were eligible to participate in the caucuses. To Penn, they might have looked like Facebook. To Obama, they looked like victory. Obama was enjoying himself, too, at Hillary's expense. He and his advisors took no small pleasure in the planted question story. The Obama press shop pushed it sub rosa with reporters and found plenty of takers. The episode was a perfect illustration of what Obama meant when he dissed textbook campaigns, and it reinforced the negative frame that Axelrod wanted to place around Hillary's portrait, that she'd do anything to win. At town halls, Obama would slyly mock Clinton by saying to the crowd, "You know what? Ask me any question. I haven't asked anybody here to ask me a certain question." The line always got a laugh. As Clinton began to take more shots at Obama, his advisors, especially Axelrod and Gibbs, both summa cum laude graduates of the School of Rapid Response Politics, were dying to return fire. But many of her shots were so maladroit that Obama found them easy to slough off. On the day she announced that the fun part was starting, her campaign put out a press release that cited an essay written by a 4 or 5 year old Obama with the title, "I Want to Be President." The point was that Obama was more ambitious than he pretended to be. It's the silly season, Obama said with a shrug at an event that night in Des Moines. I understand she's been quoting my kindergarten teacher in Indonesia. Obama's team wanted to make even more hay with the kindergarten kerfuffle. One of his ad makers hacked together a goofy web video featuring still photos of Obama as a child dressed up to look like a buccaneer. Barack Obama wanted to be president when he was in kindergarten, but there were other things he wanted. He wanted to be a pirate, the voiceover intoned melodramatically. Do we really want a pirate president? Michelle put the kibosh on that idea. She thought it diminished her husband. Ambition wasn't the only youthful excess of Obama's that the Clinton campaign injected into the conversation, however. On December 12th, Billy Shaheen, one of Hillary's national co-chairs and a veteran of New Hampshire politics, gave an interview to the Washington Post in which he cast doubt on Obama's electability. Republicans are not going to give up without a fight, Shaheen said, and one of the things they're certainly going to jump on is his drug use, a reference to Obama's acknowledgement in dreams that he dabbled with cocaine and marijuana as a young man. It'll be, when was the last time? Did you ever give drugs to anyone? Did you sell them to anyone? Obama tried to brush off Shaheen's insinuations as garden variety cheap politics, but it hadn't gone unnoticed by him that two Clinton volunteers had recently been caught forwarding emails suggesting that Obama was a Muslim with vague connections to jihadists trying to destroy America. Things seemed to be taking a turn for the ugly, and he and Michelle were certain it was no accident. Obama's brain trust agreed. Shaheen was acting as a puppet for one or both Clintons. Their suspicions weren't unreasonable. The Clintons talked about Obama's drug use with some regularity in private, citing it as another example of the willful failure of the press to vet Obama. Why are they giving him a free ride on this? The couple would complain. Why isn't it out there? Hillary's reaction to Shaheen's remarks was good for him, followed by let's push it out. Her aides violently disagreed, seeing what Shaheen had said as a PR disaster. Grudgingly, Clinton acquiesced to disowning Shaheen's comments, but she wasn't going to cut him loose. Why would Billy have to fall on his sword, she asked, for invoking something that was fair game in every recent election? Hillary was in Washington for votes in the Senate. So was Obama. The next day, as both of them prepared to fly to Des Moines for another debate, they found themselves boarding their campaign planes at the same time at Reagan National Airport. One of the strangest things about presidential campaigns is how rarely the candidates are ever in close proximity to one another. They might greet voters one county apart or brush past each other in a debate hall, but private conversations almost never happen. Yet now came an exception. Senator Clinton would like to speak with you, one of her advance people told Obama. Obama ambled over to Clinton as she stood there on the tarmac. I'm sorry about what Billy said, Hillary began. I didn't know he was going to do that. I'm not running that kind of campaign. That's fine, Hillary, Obama replied, but this wasn't an isolated incident. There were those emails in Iowa. Now, hold on a second, Clinton said, cutting Obama off, uncorking the long list of grievances she'd been stewing on for months. What about Geffen? What about attacking her about her White House papers? The list went on and on. For the next several minutes, the two went at it in an animated fashion. Bug-eyed, red-faced, waving her arms, Hillary pointed at Obama's chest. Obama tried to calm her down by putting his hand on her shoulder, but that only made her angrier. Finally, they broke from the clinch, stalking back to their respective planes. Wow, that was surreal, Obama told Axelrod. He was struck by her fury, and more than that, he thought that she seemed shaken. You could see something in her eyes, he said, something he hadn't seen before. Maybe it was fear. Maybe desperation. You know what? Obama said. We're doing something right. On her plane, Clinton related her interpretation of what had happened. I tried to apologize, she told her people, but then he started yelling. The way Obama came back at her told her that he was rattled. She couldn't believe he'd put his hand on her, violated her personal space. He's got a lot of nerve, she said. Later that day, Clinton, under pressure from her New Hampshire staff, agreed to excommunicate Shaheen. But she still had plenty of surrogates ready to sink their canines into Obama's keister. That night on MSNBC's Hardball, Penn appeared in a segment from the debate hall spin room with Trippi and with Axelrod via remote.
Chris Matthews asked about the Clinton team's turn toward negativity, and Penn replied, "The issue related to cocaine use is not something that the campaign was in any way raising." "He just did it again. He just did it again. Unbelievable," Trippi interrupted indignantly, pointing at Penn. "He just said cocaine again." "I think you're saying cocaine," Penn chuckled. "I think you're saying it." Axelrod shook his head mournfully at the sleaziness on display. Trippi fulminated further, and Penn returned to Clinton's Des Moines headquarters giddy as a schoolgirl, giggling to his colleagues. "Did you notice how many times I said cocaine?" And then there was Hillary's husband. As part of a book tour to promote his latest tome, Giving, Bill Clinton appeared on Charlie Rose the night after the verbal fisticuffs on the tarmac. He spent most of the show talking earnestly about philanthropy, but when Rose nudged him into the realm of politics, he couldn't restrain himself. A year's worth of agitation flooded out. Voters had to decide, Clinton said, if they wanted a nominee with the experience to be a change agent or were willing to roll the dice on somebody who started running for president a year after he became a senator because he's fresh, he's new, he's never made a mistake, and he has massive political skills. Bill dinged Obama for repeating a total canard about his wife pursuing a decades-long scheme to run for president. He reamed out the press for being stenographers for Obama and attributed Barack's strength in Iowa to the fact that he lived in a neighboring state. "He predicted that people would watch this interview and parse everything I said in order to get a political story and a fight going." He was right about that. His denigration of Obama on the eve of the caucuses had everyone talking. But Clinton didn't care. His attitude toward politics was in some ways simple. Always be on offense, never on defense. If someone is standing in your way, the only sensible course is to crush him. "Fuck it," he thought. "Somebody has to say this stuff, and Hillary's campaign isn't going to. I know I shouldn't have done it, but I'm glad I did." Hillary didn't blame her husband for the controversy his comments engendered, in no small part because she believed that every word he said was true. But she could see that her side's negative barrage was backfiring, that it looked like indiscriminate flailing, that all the energy in Iowa remained with Obama. Clinton began to despair. "If he's who they want, they can have him," she said, dejectedly. Then came a bolt from the blue. In years past in Iowa, the next most influential occurrence after the JJ had been the Register endorsement. Both sides had courted the paper assiduously, slavishly, and the Clintons especially so. Vilsack plotted out their strategy. Surrogates such as Madeleine Albright were enlisted to call Ed board members, and Bill laid the charm on thick with the editorial chief. Because of the paper's leftish leanings, though, most believed Obama had it cinched. Clinton happily learned otherwise on a frigid mid-December day while she was flying on a tiny chartered jet from New York to Washington. A loud, mysterious buzzing sound kept going off on the plane. Her Secret Service detail began to panic, thinking that it must be an emergency alarm, but then someone noticed an ancient airphone tucked under Hillary's seat. Headquarters was on the line with the good news about the Register. Clinton did a little dance for joy. It was the best news she'd heard in weeks. Penn and others inside Hillary land thought the Register endorsement could be a game changer. A rapid shift of strategy was called for. Out with the negative, in with the positive. Showcase Hillary's softer side. The internal advocate